Pastor Wayne Polk.
Thank you. I'll just carry it. Thank you very much. It's humbling to be in front of you without a doctorate, and I'd like you to take that into consideration. I am not a PhD, I am not a D-min. I'm a little parish priest in suburban Detroit who's trying to do ministry for the Lord and for His kingdom. And we've had the opportunity to share with you, this is the worst time of the day to present. When we run our seminars at St. Paul Church, we draw straws for time slots. The loser gets the second one after lunch. But we're going to be happy to share with you for an hour. There's some outlines being passed out. One of the guys at our seminar was telling me a story this past weekend. You probably all heard it. This guy is going hunting, and he's going hunting bear. And he's got this magnificent big gun. And he is going to find himself a bear. Now, it's the first time he's ever been bear hunting. And he climbs the mountain, and he climbs the mountain, and he climbs the mountain. He gets to the top of the mountain, he looks over the top of the mountain, and there looking right in his face is a bear. That far away. Scares him silly. He drops his gun. He goes racing down the mountain. He falls off and breaks his leg. He can't move. He's in great pain. He hears the bear charging down the mountain after him. And he has, being a Christian, he has one prayer. He says, "Dear Lord, let him be a Christian bear." And sure enough, the bear charges down the mountain, sees him, stops right next to him, gets down on his knees, folds his paws, and says, "Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest." Anyway, that's a lunch story. That's a lunch story. If you all have your outlines with you, we want to give you a little bit of an idea today of what we're going to do with you during the course of this next hour. And we're going to do it as quickly as we can. I checked the notes, I think Dr. Mathias called almost a year ago, lining up this date, and I made some notes, and he said, "Very practical from a parish perspective." So that's what we're going to try to do with you in this hour this afternoon. Some of the information that you may hear from me, I recognize any number of faces out there who have been on our campus for one of our seminars, and you're going to hear some repeat information, so let me use that as the first disclaimer. The second disclaimer is that while I'm going to talk to you about commonalities of growing churches, for us to put it in a Lutheran perspective that's practical to me and personal to me, I have to use St. Paul Church of Trenton as an example here or there. It is not an example that we would encourage everybody to follow, because what we do at our place would certainly be very much the wrong thing for some of you to do at your place. We have spent over the last 13 years in suburban Detroit building a congregation that is Great Commission oriented. We have done that on a number of different levels. But one of the things that we have done most is we have gone around the United States with our staff and we have studied growing churches. We've taken a look at them. We've tried to learn from them. And what we have found is that growing churches do things very much the same way. The converse is also true, by the way. We have found that non-growing churches do things very much the same way. And so I wanted in this hour time slot today to just share with you what some growing churches do. Commonalities, I call them, of growing churches, so that you can take your congregations, wherever you're ministering, either on a pastoral level or a staff level or a lay leadership level, and apply some of these commonalities to your own congregation, because then we can all grow. Within the past recent time, I've just had three other outstanding opportunities of visiting growing churches. I had the opportunity to spend 3 or 4 days with Frank Barker Sr. at Briarwood Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, Alabama, a congregation with an average Sunday morning attendance of 2,250. It's 25 years old. Started in a storefront in a shopping center in Birmingham, and now is on three different campuses. A staff of 111 in this congregation. 2,250 in church on Sunday, and a budget of $2.7 million. That congregation is sponsoring missionaries in 40 different countries of the world. And to be able to sit with Frank Barker and his staff for 3 or 4 days, you learn. And these are some of the things we're going to try to apply. The second one that I've spent some time with recently is with Stu Briscoe. Stuart Briscoe is at Elmbrook Church on the west side of Milwaukee. It's a non-denominational church, now averaging about 4,000 in worship on a Sunday. It used to be Elmbrook Baptist Church. And as a result of some problems within the congregation, they became non-denominational. Stu Briscoe took over. And now they are just opening their fifth campus in the Mohawk area. There's Elmbrook, and then there's Elmbrook South, North, East, and West that are developing, all of which are doing very, very well. And then one other, most recently, I had a chance to stay in my own backyard and spend 3 or 4 days with a pastor by the name of Bartlett Hess. He's at Ward Presbyterian Church in Livonia, Michigan, a congregation that worships about 3,700 each Sunday. Bart Hess, I met him for the first time at the American Festival of Evangelism in Kansas City any number of years ago. I couldn't believe he was pastor of this mega church. He was at that time about 70 years old. He's now about 76 or 7. A short, small, little man. And when I got to his congregation, I found such an excitement. As a matter of fact, I found that the block next to the church is made up simply of homes that the church has purchased, so they have a place to house their returning missionaries that they are themselves sending around the world. In addition, it was the week before I was there, and that there was an excitement in that church because this congregation had just bought 100 acres for relocation at the price of $14.5 million just for the property. And they're going to totally relocate and build a sanctuary that will seat somewhere in the area of 6,000 or 7,000, led by a pastor who is now 76 years old, but enthused with the gospel, and enthused with what it can do. So on the basis of these and others that we visit and that we study, I'd like to share with you 12 things about growing churches that they have in common. First of all, let me just run through the outline. The outline's in front of you just so you understand a little bit where we're going, and we'll try to just highlight points here this afternoon. What is the purpose of the congregation? Growing churches know. Secondly, growing churches have a philosophy of ministry. Non-growing churches usually do not. Or if they do, it is not understood or clearly stated. Growing churches understand their communities better than non-growing churches do. Growing churches understand themselves, their own growth history, their past better. Consequently, they can take their past, move it up to the present, and under God's leadership and guidance, project it into the future. Growing churches staff in a different way than non-growing churches. Growing churches understand their own people better than non-growing churches. Growing churches have a set of priorities clearly established. Growing churches have developed a strategy for ministry. Growing churches have certain kind of facility emphasis that non-growing churches do not have. Growing churches do a little bit of a different thing with finances than non-growing churches. Growing churches program differently than non-growing churches. And growing churches know where they're going to be 25 years from now. Non-growing churches don't know where they're going to be 25 hours from now. master planning, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and 25 years ahead. Master planning is a major part of ministry in churches that grow rapidly. Let's start from the top, and let's talk a little bit about the purpose of growing churches. Let me just say, from a management perspective, and this really doesn't have a whole lot to do just with church management, but from a management perspective, a clearly defined, a uniform, a statement of purpose is very vital to any organization. Growing churches understand that a statement of purpose answers two questions. The first question that a statement of purpose answers is, what business are we in? It's amazing how many churches do not know that, where it is not clearly understood. Secondly, a statement of purpose answers the question, what is the scope of the business we're in? We know at our congregation, and you certainly know at yours, that you can't do everything you would want to do. You can't do it all at once, and so you have to have a scope. Now, you see, this purpose, when it's generally understood among the congregations and the members, is the thread that really ties together the activities of all of the subgroupings within an organization. And when the purpose is fuzzy, the individual committees, the individual units within that organization tend to segment. That's when congregational meetings or annual meetings become the Third World War. When there is not a clearly understood and clearly defined statement of purpose in that organization, and they go different directions, which clearly conflict. Now, let me tell you where you find your statement of purpose in your congregation. Your congregation may think that the statement of purpose of your congregation is found in the Constitution. I'll tell you where it's found. The statement of purpose in your congregation is found in your budget. That's where your statement of purpose is found. Let me give you an example. I was doing a seminar not long ago at one of our churches in Houston. When I came down there, I always ask for a printed statement of purpose from the congregation before I go in. I walked into this beautiful facility in Houston, congregation with a $400,000 budget. Their statement of purpose indicated that they were in the business of reaching the lost, that their purpose for existence was to reach the lost. Out of their $400,000 budget, $250,000 of it went for their parochial school. Now, what am I saying? That is not a value judgment, by the way, one way or another. But the first responsibility then becomes for them to understand what business they're in and what is the scope of the business they were in. Obviously, for $250,000, if they were in business of winning the lost, they could have hired 10 graduates from the evangelism program in St. Paul. Your purpose is found in your budget. Secondly, the way you can support knowing what the purpose is in your congregation is you look on your monthly calendar. Because where you put your dollars and where you put your time is where your purpose is in your congregation. You know, it's amazing visiting congregations with a budget of $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 a year. They say that they are there to do great commission ministry and to win the lost for Jesus Christ, and you see $800 budgeted for evangelism. And you know immediately that there's conflict within that congregation as to what its purpose is. I don't want to bore you with another Don McGavran statement. You've probably heard him, and those of you who know some church growth know this one well. But growing churches, amazingly enough, have this as their purpose. It is God's will as church grow,
and as lost children are found. I am shocked at how many churches I go and see that have this hanging on walls to reemphasize that purpose among the members of that individual congregation. This summer, we were vacationing up in northern Michigan at the Traverse City area and went to a little mission congregation in its first or second year of existence in Interlaken. And we know that best, I guess, if we're from the United States, with an outstanding music academy. Pastor Tim Mowry is the mission developer there, and walked in the front door, and there, over their guest register, right as you walk in the door, this little building, it's God's will is church grow, and that is lost children be found. By the way, I'll report to you a number of months later, guess what's happening in that church? It's growing. Because that congregation formed around Great Commission purposes. Okay. Understand the importance of purpose again, because priority, strategy, style of ministry vary according to the understanding of one's purpose. And so it does in life. Secondly, let's talk about philosophy of ministry. Growing churches have found what works. Growing churches have found what works. If you want to define philosophy of ministry, I do it by saying philosophy of ministry equals what works. That's a congregation's philosophy of ministry. In most cases, these churches have come to their philosophy of ministry by trial and error. That's how you develop it. That's how you reach it. It was a number of years ago now that I was attending a seminar in New Jersey led by two people from World Vision, Ted Engstrom and Ed Dayton. And they run outstanding seminars throughout the country, Christian time management, etc. And Ted Engstrom told a story then that I have told in every seminar I've ever conducted. So those of you who've been on the campus at Trenton, you've heard it, but you're going to have to hear it again, because although it is not a hilarious story, it is a vital story to the understanding of how philosophy of ministry is developed. And the story is this, that there's a 31-year-old bank executive who has just been called in and told that within 6 months' time he will become president of his local bank. He knows very little about it. He doesn't know much about what being a CEO, a chief executive officer, means. He's scared stiff. He's honored. But he needs information. And so he is trying to seek information, and he gets a suggestion from someone. I said, well, look, the chairman of the board of this bank is 76 years old. He's been in banking for 50-plus years. He's a former president of this bank. Why don't you go talk to him? So he does. He makes an appointment. He goes into the beautiful padded office, and he says, my name is so-and-so, and as you may know, I have just been appointed president of this bank to take over in 6 months. I need some real help. How does one become a good bank president? And the venerable, honorable chairman of the board says, two words, right decisions. And the guy said, boy, I think that's really helpful, I guess. Right decisions. He said, maybe I didn't phrase my question correctly. Maybe what I want to know is, how do you make right decisions? And the venerable, honorable chairman of the board says, one word, experience. And the fellow says, wow, this guy is really incisive. But maybe he doesn't understand my question. He said, maybe what I'm really asking you is, how do you get that kind of experience? And the venerable, honorable chairman of the board says, two words, wrong decisions. And so it is in life. Growing churches make more wrong decisions than non-growing churches. Growing churches find out what works by trial and error. It is not unusual, and I find it all the time. Growing churches are not jealous of their decisions. They are not intent on proving the correctness of their decisions. And so their philosophy of ministry develops with experience based on wrong decisions. Wrong decisions can take a whole bunch of different avenues. I remember back in 1974, in our congregation, we had, for 33 years, had Advent and Lenten services on Wednesday nights. Okay? The problem in our congregation was that nobody came. And so we talked to the people, we tried to evaluate it exactly what the problem was, why people weren't coming to our Advent services or Lenten services. And we found out a number of things about us. First of all, we're a managerial congregation. We have a lot of guys that travel during the week. We have a lot of educators who have PTA meetings or PTL meetings on Wednesday evenings. We were losing in competition to Holy Bowling. We were getting mixed up with kids' athletics. And so a determination was made by our board to move our Advent and Lenten services to Sunday evenings. You should have heard the response. And the response was kind of like this. Pastor, don't you understand that Lutherans worship on Wednesday evening? Baptists worship on Sunday evening. We moved to Sunday evening, and to make a very long story short, the attendance increased threefold the first year, simply because in our community, Sunday is a family day, it's a more casual day, there's more time. Now, again, this isn't one of those things I'm saying try Sunday evenings if you got lousy Advent attendance. What I am saying, though, is never have anything outside of your theology, of course, so set in concrete that you can't improve it. Okay, philosophy of ministry. Let me just say that growing churches, in addition, have this thing in common about their philosophy of ministry, and that is that they run a very high commitment ministry. They run a higher commitment ministry than non-growing congregations. I found an interesting thing after being a Kiwanian for about a dozen years. I was driving home from a Kiwanis meeting one night after we were, had just spent a lot of time planning one of these little one-day circuses for the benefit of some children's hospital in the Detroit area. And I was thinking about Kiwanis. I was going back to my congregation for another meeting. And as I'm driving along, I say to myself, do you know, Paul, that the Kiwanis Club demands higher commitment than the church? And I almost got sick to my stomach. And I found, though, in studying growing churches, that growing churches require higher commitment levels than non-growing churches. Do you understand that the lost out there are looking for something to give their life to give their heart to, not just another little thing on their calendar. At St. Paul Church, and I said I would have to give you a Lutheran example of how we do it sometimes in philosophy of ministry, we tell our people when they come in that regular worship attendance is part of the package in our congregation. Now, that doesn't seem to be unfair, I guess. I think there's good scripture to support that. We are a sacramental church, and so we tell our people that regular communion attendance is one of our keys to discipleship, and we will monitor it in their lives. You do too. We tell them that service through the use of spiritual gifts is something that we're going to monitor in their lives as they grow in their faith, grow in their relationship to the Lord. We require Bible study in our congregation. Participation in some kind of Bible study, either cellular or on a congregational level in our parish. It's one of our keys to discipleship. When I came to my congregation, I didn't have any elders going to Bible study. Here are the guys making the spiritual decisions for the congregation and never opened the Word. We're a tithing congregation. We strive toward a tithe or increases thereof. We could talk more about that. I don't want to. I was at one of these sessions, I think it was here at the seminary, as a matter of fact, last year, and somebody said, Lenski said, tithing is no good. I said, good. We encourage our people in that area. We feel it is a fair response to God's love. It's a biblical indicator. When we get Christians in from the outside, as we live to do as a congregation, or non-Christians into the family, we understand that they've been living in the world all these years and consequently are not able to come in at that 10% level, and we know that, but we covenant with them at that point. If they can come in at 2%, we ask them what their commitment may be with regard to increasing that 1% a year until they reach that point. They're able to handle that and do it joyfully. Participation in a fellowship group is our last key to discipleship that we use. And again, I don't suggest any of these six to you. I am just telling you that it is our way of saying we are committed to commitment on the part of our membership and on the part of our leadership. So much for philosophy of ministry. Let's move on to the fact that growing churches understand their community better than non-growing churches. Growing churches understand their community better than non-growing churches. In 1977, we had a group in from the outside, a consultant agency, to study our community for us. And they did. And they told us a lot about ourselves. They found out that we were suburban. I think we knew that. They told us that we live, that our church is in a prestige residential neighborhood. It's outside the city limits of Detroit. That most of the people who attend our church commute into the city of Detroit or into Dearborn and do not work in our own community. We found out at that time, we were shocked to find out that we had 107 degreed teachers in our congregation, reflective of the community. The community we're in has an outstanding school system, and educators move into that community so our kids can go to the schools there. We found out that we were in a community that was filled, and so it is. As a matter of fact, the population of Trenton, Michigan was about 26,000 in 1977. It's now about 24,800. It is declining as the cost of the homes increases, the age of those who can buy the homes increases, and so it is a second or third home community. It's not a starter home community. But we found out something most important to us, and that was we found out when we studied our community that within six circumferential miles of the front door of our building, there were 52,000 unchurched people. Within six circumferential miles of the front door of our building, there were 52,000 unchurched people. I was talking to one of you, I won't mention who it was, on the phone earlier in the week, who was telling me that their ministry area has 72,000 unchurched people that they can reach and that they can serve. Now, imagine what that does to your head when you find that out. I want to tell you personally that sometimes you have trouble sleeping at night if you think of 52,000 people who don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ within 6 miles of the front door of your church, people that you should be able to reach. It was a turning point for our congregation. We decided that in the Lord's name we were going to go get us some. And we thought that we were enough alike, maybe 10% of those, that we could effectively witness and effectively evangelize them. Know your community. It's important for you to be aware of the community in which you are in. It determines the kind of programming you do. It determines the kind of outreach that you do. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about growth history. Growing churches find out that they take good care of themselves statistically. Any of you who've been in Kent's process or any of the other processes, Wynn's process, know that you're constantly in the records. You're constantly in the records because you find out so much about the records that tell you something about the future. Now, you got to be careful what records you study, by the way. Let me just tell you that growing churches do not operate on the basis of total membership. Your total membership statistics, I know ours were pretty much meaningless. When I came to St. Paul Trenton in 74, we had 540 communicant members who had not received the sacrament in 2 years or more. And the next 2 years were the worst 2 years of my life because I saw every one of them. And I want to tell you, we looked like a large church. We were not. Growing churches use an interesting formula, at least the majority of the ones we visited. They say the size of their congregation is their membership, or excuse me, their Sunday morning worship annual attendance average plus 10% is probably the amount of members they do have. Now, that's helpful in planning and programming and strategizing and setting our priorities for us to understand that even though we show 1,000 people on the books, if we get 200 in worship on Sunday, our size congregation is probably 220. You can add the 10% because you probably have some college students. We probably have some shut-ins, probably have some people on vacation or ill on that given Sunday. But 10 to 20% plus your average Sunday attendance is probably the size of the congregation that you have. But growth history, very important. We learn so much with regard to growth history. Let me give you an example of what we learn. And I'm not bringing these statistics out for any reason except to make a point of what we can learn through those. At St. Paul Church, we were faced with a situation in conversion growth that back in 1973, we had confirmed about 13 adults, either through confirmation or reaffirmation, brought in from the pagan pool, from the outside, about 13 adults. We went up, we had a big jump in 74. That was when we had our first consultants in. That's when we sat down and really said, hey, what do we exist for? That's when we developed a purpose. We balanced off after that because we didn't have great enthusiasm, but as you can see, in 82, we confirmed 169. Last Sunday, we took in 47. I don't know what it'll be this year. This may be our first 200 adult confirmation year. And we're really thankful to God for that. But the history tells us that that certainly should be only the beginning and certainly should not be the end. It doesn't make too much difference what kind of an area you put up here. Let me show you one more. Vacation Bible School, we'll put up here for you quickly. We ran into a problem with Vacation Bible School in 1977-78. You can see the downtrend. And the reason we did that is we ran out of room. Our facility, when we had 250 or 260 kids in it, it was packed. Now, let me tell you what we did. Now, last year, I guess we had 744 or something. But in 83, we had 727 in our VBS. The reason that this happened was now what we do to overcome the problem is each of these years, we added a campus. And so we have Vacation Bible School now simultaneously on four campuses, on our own campus, and then we rent public schools during the summer. Vacant, people are very, very happy to give you the opportunity to rent their facilities. And so now, if we're going to increase, we know we're going to have to rent more public schools in a broader area surrounding the church. By the way, it's a great idea for ministry because it gets you out where the unchurched are. It doesn't ask them to bring their kids to your campus. really effective. Okay, enough about growth history. I want to talk about staffing. I wish we had, we could really do, let me just say it's the most important single factor in growing churches, is staffing. Let me say in addition that the only thing that pays for itself almost immediately in budget outlay is the right staff member. I said the right staff member. Wrong staff members don't pay for themselves. Growing churches understand that. Growing churches staff much more heavily than non-growing churches. Growing churches use a percentage of about 1 to 100 in worship on Sunday should require a full-time program staff. The faster they're growing, the lower the number. I can give you back a number of years ago, I guess, yeah, it was December of 1980. I don't know if you can see us in the back, and it isn't horribly important, but one of our consultants did a study of churches of all denominations were growing about the same rate. Many denominational churches, over 700 in attendance on a Sunday morning, and we were really pleased. There was St. Paul Lutheran Church of Trenton, Michigan, along with Mariners Church in Newport Beach and others. We were really excited and pleased, except what this graph shows was that Van Nuys Baptist Church, with 1,600 people in attendance, has one full-time staff member for every 31 people in worship. St. Paul Church of Trenton, our church, had one full-time staff member for every 167 in worship. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out which church serves their people better. And it was shortly after this that we added staff. We had three staff during the course of that year and have been doing so on a regular basis since. A couple of other watch phrases or catchphrases about staffing. Long-term staff is vitally important. All growing churches have long-term staff. And that we can say almost without exception. The converse is not true. Not all long-term staff people have growing churches. But growing churches have long-term ministry going on. It has something really to say, I'm afraid, about the idea that perhaps some district presidents have or whatever, that you should really move a guy every 5 or 7 years. Growing churches find that that doesn't work. It takes 3 years to get to know the guy. It takes 5 years to get to trust him. It takes another couple or 3 years to follow him. And then the most effective ministry starts in most cases. A couple of other things about staff. Growing churches, and this we'll all love to hear, but growing churches pay better than non-growing churches. Do you think there's any correlation between that and the reason that they have long-term staff? I think there may indeed be some correlation between that. They pay well. They expect more, by the way. They have very intricate job descriptions. They have performance evaluations. Our performance evaluations at our place start the 12th of May. And the evaluation, everybody in life is accountable. Everybody in life is accountable, and we work more effectively when we're accountable. Business has found that out. Growing churches take staff very seriously. Next, the congregation. Some of these we're going to have to go through really quickly. Growing churches know their own people, and they understand their own congregation. And consequently, they're able to do ministry to them in a more effective way. Non-growing churches very often don't even know the makeup of their own parish. And you make decisions on the makeup of your parish. Now, all of you have done this. That's why I brought along. This is just an age profile we did back a number of years ago. We had 1,425 people on the books at that time. We were trying to determine what kind of a staff person to add at that particular time, and we found out that the highest number of people we had in any area was between the area of 16 and 20. We had 173 of those. Second highest was 11 to 15. We had 158. And third highest was 21 to 25, which was 152. Can anybody guess what staff person we added? Right. Right. See, so some of these things we don't have to get advanced degrees to figure out. Some of these things we proceed to then call our director of youth and young adult ministry at St. Paul Church. Well, okay. So that's know thyself, basically. Okay. Let's move on to the other side of the page. Priorities. Growing churches set priorities, because priorities play a very key role in churches. Generally, in these churches, and I say generally because there's some exception, but in most of these growing churches that we have studied, the priorities are clearly understood and they're well defined. And the congregation knows about them. You can go up, it always amazes me when you can go up to people in worship on a Sunday morning and say, why does your church exist? And they know. And they know. And what priorities does this congregation have at this time in its history? And they know. They can tell you. It's beautiful. Now, you can have different priorities. I don't know what your priorities are where you serve. You can have worship, teaching, discipling, missions, fellowship, organizations. Some churches exist to exist. You can have facilities. Some congregations exist for their facilities. You can tell that by looking at their budget. Other congregations exist for social concerns. Others are strongly evangelistic. But what I'm saying to you is that in growing churches, the priorities are understood. And let me just add to that, that a church's location among a certain type of people in a certain type of community influences the kind of priorities that are adopted. Okay, let's move on to strategy. Growing churches, interestingly enough, operate under a game plan. And that's a term that we're familiar with. That's really what strategy is. It's a game plan for accomplishing your goals. In most of them, this game plan is very carefully spelled out and verbalized. In others, it's there, although it's not as clearly defined, or it's not as clearly understood. I want to take the time to run through this. I don't know. There may be one person here who hasn't seen it, but I think it's, if you haven't seen it, this is from a Peter Wagner, see Peter Wagner thing years ago. 8 biblical building blocks for developing a godly strategy. These are all quotes from the book of Proverbs, living Proverbs. Proverbs 13:16, a wise man thinks ahead, a fool doesn't and even brags about it. Proverbs 14:8, the wise man looks ahead, the fool attempts to fool himself and won't face the facts. Proverbs 18:13, what a shame, yes, how stupid to decide before knowing the facts. Proverbs 15:22, plans go wrong with too few counselors. Many counselors bring success. Proverbs 16:9, we should make plans, counting on God to direct us. Proverbs 16:1, we can make our plans, but the final outcome is in God's hands. My favorite, Proverbs 13:19. It is pleasant to see plans develop. That's why fools refuse to give them up even when they're wrong. And then, Proverbs 18:15, the intelligent man is always open to new ideas. In fact, he looks for them. He looks for them. That's good Bible. That's good Bible for developing a strategy in the church. Okay, let's move on. Let's take a look at facilities, just briefly. The first thing that growing churches have found about facilities is that facilities do not produce growth. And that's extremely important. We get ourselves into major hot water if we believe facilities produce growth. We in our congregation found that out firsthand, painfully, because we built, those of you who are on our campus know our facility. We built an American Colonial Church, New England Colonial Church, in 1968. That is one of the last of its kind in the United States. There is 18-karat gold leaf around the windows.
chandeliers that cost back in 68 about $18,000 a piece. A real showpiece. You can't afford to build that kind of church anymore. It was built in 1968, followed by seven declining years. And why was that? Several reasons. The purpose of the leadership of the congregation between 1965 and 1968 was to build a church. That's what they lived for. That was their purpose. The second reason was they developed a mentality that said, if we get that kind of a building, the people are just going to run in the doors. Neither of the above were true. They didn't. So facilities facilitate growth, and growing churches know that. Secondly, let me just add a comment about facilities in that middle to upper middle class people that Lutherans usually work best with, most effectively with, appear to place a higher premium on things like neatness and cleanliness and overall appearance of facilities. And so that just becomes important. Growing churches. Since we're in a building program ourselves right now, a major one, this is one of the things we have been writing growing churches about. The most important two factors in terms of facilities for growing churches are, number one, parking. Number one, parking. If you can't park them, you can't seat them. And we're faced with a situation today that shopping center developers have told us over the years, and we now find it to be true, that people will not walk more than 200 feet. So the amount of parking you have 200 feet from your doors is indicative of your growth potential. It's indicative of your growth potential. The second thing that we want to emphasize to you in growing churches is most important is nurseries. Nurseries, vitally important in reaching the lost. And not just nurseries, well-staffed, well-equipped, clean, developed, educational nurseries. There's a good biblical injunction that emphasizes the value of nurseries. And that biblical injunction is, blessed are they who hear the word of God and keep it. You have to understand, if you are a church that is living for the lost, understand the lost in your community. They come into your church on a Sunday morning. First of all, some of them don't even want to be there. They're being dragged there by friends, neighbors, somebody in their web. They're being dragged in. They come in, and you know what? They always come right a minute before church starts. And so they want to sneak in. You know where they sit? They sneak in the back and sit in one of the back pews. And you know who else is back there? All the babies. Okay? And they can't hear, perhaps, or they feel uncomfortable, and out they go. Growing churches grow on their nurseries, really grow on their nurseries. I have seen, in visiting these churches, some of the most elaborate, Shearer Hills Baptist. Are you familiar, Steve, with Shearer Hills Baptist in San Antonio? I want to tell you that the nursery facilities boggle. They're magnificent. A church grows on its young families. You have to have a place so your mothers who come in with little babies aren't going to be embarrassed, and don't think they're not going to be embarrassed if their youngster's screaming and there's no place for them to go. The third thing about them, which is a very basic thing, by the way, is signs, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. But when a church lives for itself, it doesn't need a lot of signs. For instance, you can walk around some of the churches we visit that are not in a growth posture, and you will find, you will catch yourself walking around that facility for 20 minutes and you can't find the pastor's office because there are no signs there. Worse than that, you can't find a bathroom because there are no signs there. Now, what's the mentality that says? The mentality that says is all of our members know where the pastor's office is. So a purpose has just been developed. We live for the sake of our members and not for the sake of our lost. Finances. Finances. What kind of a story do finances tell? Church growth congregations know that. Let me just give you some stuff that we have found developing in
growing churches, growing churches usually will not spend more than 25% on indebtedness. Okay, you may want to keep that in mind. We found that was important for us to know right now with the project we're in. 25%. And the reason for that, by the way, is what we just said before, that facilities don't bring people into the church. What brings people into the church is programming. And so, if you get yourself in such a box with your debt payments that you can't program, you're not going to grow. It doesn't make any difference what kind of building you have. Secondly, growing churches spend between 45 and 55% of their budget on staff. 45 to 55%. This is ministry staff. I'm not including school staff. We would include that part of it. Let me say you have a teacher in your school or a teacher in the school who gives 20% of their time for youth work or something like that. We would include that 20%. Okay. I'm going to move on. Program. Just want to say a couple of things about programs. It was in 1975. It was in 1975 when one consultant came to work with our staff to try to get us working in the same direction, and the consultant came in and said the following. Said, the unchurched do not join the church for theological reasons. They join the church for sociological reasons. Okay. And as a graduate of the Springfield Seminary, as someone who had done about 8 or 9 years of ministry in a different place, I resented it, but I thought about it. And I came from a mission congregation on the west side of the state of Michigan in Grand Rapids that grew rapidly, and we confirmed 50, 60, 70, 80 adults a year. And I tried to think of one that came in because of our position on predestination or even Holy Communion. Now, what am I not saying? What I am not saying is that people don't stay because of their theology. You teach them their theology. People, if they move, will transfer because of their theology. But the unchurched don't join a church because of theology, but because of sociology. I'm absolutely convinced of it. Absolutely convinced of it. And what we do is we have a company that we hire that runs telephone surveys of the unchurched in our community, and we find out what their greatest needs are. And we develop programming for those needs. Let me give you an example of one church. This came way back in 1980-something. I think it was the first church growth packet ever put out by a publishing company. And this was David C. Cook. And what they did was took one Southern California church and indicated how they programmed to reach the lost. You don't see a whole lot of theology in there. Softball teams, Dodger night, they had a big deal in Southern California where they rented thousands of seats and invited the whole community. Easter, Christmas choral programs, mother-daughter nights, family nights, noon meals. You have to program to reach the lost. You have to program to reach the lost. Do not have a symposium on the Lutheran confessions. And put it in the newspaper. There's nothing wrong with the Lutheran confessions. Maybe you should have one for your own people on that. But if your goal in life is to reach the lost, you've got to reach them in such a way that you will scratch where they itch. One example of programming. Sometimes it's just a matter of looking at census tracts. We have a guy on our staff that just spends hours and hours on census tracts. And he discovered in one of the census tracts that in 1984, in our community, that there were more adults, 18 years of age and older, who were single than were married. Okay?
More adults 18 years of age and older who are single and married. And by the way, that's probably the case in your community, if you live in a metropolitan area. That's single again, you know, widowed, divorced, separated, or never married. And at that point began the beginning of single dimension ministry in our congregation, because we looked at our church calendar and all we had were family events. The whole thing was family events. Parents, kids, 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 mixed doubles bowling. And Singles Dimension Ministry started, which now has a mailing list of 700 singles that we serve one way or another in the community. And the majority of those singles are unchurched. The majority of those singles are unchurched. That's the mission field of the future. Our problem is our schools have not, as of yet, adequately trained people to minister in that area. Okay, finally, master plan, and I've talked about it again. I just want to say that this was our old master plan. This was our planting master plan. We've now thrown that away. That was one of those wrong decisions that didn't work for us. But we were going to go to a pure satellite concept with a common staff on 7 campuses. It was a real dream and a real master plan. And, by the way, it would have worked, except it didn't. And so we had to throw it out and start over. And so now we've got a totally new one-generational plan in force, in effect, and we'll see what the Lord does with that. My time is up. I just wanted to close with something I use to close a lot. It's a true story. One of my favorite little true stories. It's a Dwight Moody story. It's true Dwight Moody, the great Baptist evangelist. And he was speaking before a group of people one day in Chicago, and he was telling them about his plan for saving the lost. And one guy came up to him after the presentation and said, "Dwight Moody, I don't like your plan for saving the lost." And Dwight Moody said, "Well, you know, sometimes I don't either. Tell me about your plan." And the guy says, "We don't have a plan." And Dwight Moody said, "I like mine better." And I guess the reason I say that is that we've got to, I think, in our church body, start dreaming some dreams and having some visions and making some plans about what God can do. If we believe we've got some pretty solid theology, if we believe the gospel is being proclaimed, if we believe the Lord wants his church to grow, then let's get on. Thank you.